Chandanar and I agreed between us that he doesn't really need to introduce me. Because I've only just 2 weeks ago I was leading this class, so you all know who I am already. So, I don't really know what to say after that film, because it's kind of the film said what I would have said if I was going to give a talk on that time, more or less. I did think about it this afternoon, wondering what I would say. But now that I've seen the film, I think perhaps you probably got a pretty good idea of what was going on at the time from the film. So I don't perhaps need to say very much about what the film's already said, the objective circumstances with the building of the London Buddhist Centre and all that kind of thing. I don't think I really need to say that. So maybe I'll just be a bit more personal and talk about what it was like for me. I was thinking just over the weekend, not quite knowing what I was going to say, I was thinking, I wonder how objective I can be anyway. I was a young, very young guy in those days, 20 years old. And I think when you're that old, probably, at least this is in my case, I was very impressionable. And when I, there's a bit of background to my involvement in that my family home broke up. My mum left my dad and my dad became alcoholic and the whole family just exploded. And I ended up moving to London. And even my move to London was a kind of panic move because I'd moved to a town and I was living with four other guys, actually. It wasn't a Buddhist, it was more like a Grateful Dead community. And I had a job in a hospital as a porter. And the one of the guys insisted on playing music into the early hours of the morning. And I just had to get out of that house. And something came up in London I could move to, so I did. So I was rootless, familyless in a way, and didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I had no idea. Didn't know what I was going to do. And so there I was in London. I started working in music publishers. And as I was saying, I was young, and I would say now, looking back, wide open. I was just wide open to experience and very impressionable. So sometime around that time, I also worked as a groundsman at Brunel University in Uxbridge. And we had one of the students coming to work with us over the summer. And he was into Carlos Castaneda. That's the time it was. People were into Carlos Castaneda. Some of you haven't heard of him, no doubt. But if you're around 30 years ago, you will have heard of Carlos Castaneda. And it was a kind of Mexican mystical thing. And he was into him. And I was impressed because I was impressionable. So when I moved up to London, I decided I wanted to learn how to meditate. So I went along to a few different places. And in those days, there was a book by Nick Sanders called Alternative London. And if you remember, look at the colour of our hair. In those days, if you were part of the alternative, you had that book if you lived in London. And anything you wanted was in that book. And so there was a whole section of mystical and religious, spiritual groups, not religious. We didn't have religious groups in the counterculture. We had spiritual groups and mystical groups. And so I went along to the few of the places that were advertised there. And I kind of thought they were okay. But when I went to the Pundarika Centre, you saw some pictures of it there. The old piano, it wasn't a piano factory, actually. It was a piano warehouse. And ex-piano warehouse. And I went along there. And I don't know why, I just felt immediately at home. Some famous, famous within the FWBO order members teaching there at the time, Subhuti, Lokamitra, Marichi, Dhammadina, Hridaya, and Kamala Sheela. And I was impressed. I was impressed by the people teaching. Where I'd been to before, I remember going to a lecture on TM, Transcendental Meditation, and it was a couple, talk given by a couple of young women, and I just thought they seemed a bit fey and didn't really impress me. But I have to say that when I went along to the Pundurika Centre, the people there who were teaching seemed down to earth and earthy in a way. They didn't seem strange and weird, and I felt, as I say, I felt at home. Probably they were dressed and had hair similar to mine as well. That's probably a lot to do with it. You know, that's the kind of thing that you're getting interested in, isn't it? People who seem to be into the same kind of things as you. But yeah, as I said in that film, there was one night when we were meditating, the beginners class, and God, it was so frightening. Just these bricks just came through the window. It was really scary, you know, because you can imagine sitting here in a beginner's meditation class and somebody's leading it, and suddenly, smash! It really made you jump out of your skin. It was really quite frightening. But the Pundurika Centre was in this area that was being redeveloped, great big redevelopment area. And it was very, very run down, and a lot of the houses were empty because the council were taking people out of the area so it could be redeveloped. And in those days, young people squatted. Do you know what I mean by squatting? What you did is there would be a house that's empty, and you would claim squatter's rights. You would just move in, and just by being there, you were allowed to be there. It was legal just to be there. So there were lots and lots of people squatting in that area. It was a real alternative scene. In fact, one of the houses was a bakery. Somebody had converted it into a bakery, and they made bread, wholemeal bread, of course, for all and sundry around the place. And it was like really, really cheap because they had no rent to pay on their premises. So there was all these people living on benefits in these squats, buying food from this bakery, and it all worked really, really well for this little enclave of people. And some of the squats were Buddhist communities belonging to the FWO. And I'll tell you something. I went to a beginner's class, and they advertised that they were running a jumble sale the following weekend. This is a Wednesday beginner's class. The jumble sale was Saturday, and I volunteered and went and along. I suppose what that says is I didn't have very much else to do in those days. On the negative side, on the positive side, it meant that I was into it. And that's where I met Suitor. You saw Suitor on the film. He was one of the first people I met, and he's still a good friend. I have to say, actually, the film had quite a big effect on me. I've never seen that before. And I did feel quite sad, actually. And I'm just trying to work out why. And I think it is the simple fact of impermanence. I mean, it's fun to see these people who we know are quite old now and middle age going on for old age. And there they were, young, idealistic, counterculture people, subversive, with long hair and scruffy clothes. In a way, it's quite fun, but in a way, actually, it isn't. I found it quite sad. Two of the people who were in that film have died. Ajita, there was part of his funeral there, who was a real character from Glasgow, from the tenements in Glasgow. And the other one was Punya, who eventually went to live in America, and he died just last year. And some of those people are no longer involved with the movement. So it just felt, I don't know, there's this kind of poignancy as I watched it. But anyway, back to the story. I was able to get involved very quickly because I had nothing else. I was working in the music publishers, and it wasn't the top end of the music publishers. It was very much the bottom end of the music publishers. And I wasn't really interested in the job, and I really had nothing to do with my life. So I suppose I was looking for something to really engage me. And you probably got the impression there, I hope you got the impression, that it was really quite exciting. There were these young, very dynamic people. There was a lot of energy. There's a kind of very much kind of we can do anything kind of energy. Sabuti there talking about this fire station, saying they can do it in £15,000 in 6 months. Then it took over 2 years and £250,000. That's the kind of thing. We were just into doing anything. So it was very easy for me to get involved. And it must have been maybe a month after I was coming along to the beginners classes. Sabuti took myself and Sua to a side and said, look, a house has come up on this street, the very street that the centre was on. Some people had moved out and we could just move in and start a community. So we did. What became obvious once we moved in was that the reason Sabuti was very keen for us to move in there was because he was in number five with a men's community. In number one was a women's community, Dharmadina, Anomar, a few others. And in between was a house full of drug addicts, which made life very difficult for the people round about them. So as soon as it became empty, he was very, very keen it became a community. So I remember very clearly clearing the house out. There was it was very strange because there was one bedroom where there was just this pile of rubbish in the middle of the floor. And as we cleared the pile of rubbish away, we realised that the person who lived there had painted the floor. He painted all around the rubbish. So when we cleared the rubbish away, that part of the floor wasn't painted. It was a really strange kind of atmosphere. And I actually had to go to a doctor or a hospital, I can't remember now, because as I was clearing things, a needle from one of the syringes went into my finger. It was a strange, weird atmosphere. But anyway, we did clear it, and a number of people helped us. It was great. And five of us lived there, three men, Suata, myself, and someone who later became Mari Chitta. We weren't Suata and Ratnaguna then. We were just beginners to the whole thing. And two women, Sue Fox. There's a Sue Fox involved in this centre, but this is another Sue Fox. And another woman whose name I can no longer remember, although I remember her very clearly. And we lived there. We didn't really know what we were doing in terms of community, but we lived there. And I left my job in the music publishers and I started working in what's called Community Cafe, which was across the Heath. Had to walk across Hampstead Heath to get there. At Swiss Cottage, there was this place called Community Cafe, which was a squat cafe. And I started working there. And it was, you know, we paid ourselves £3.50 a day. And we made bread first thing in the morning. Someone had to get there at 6 and make wholemeal bread for the day. And then the others get there and we started making soups and stuff like that. And it was just full of people from the alternative culture, you know, just wanting some way to earn a living. But it was also part of the scene, you know. Hippie-type people went along, and that was it. And I ended up running that cafe after a little while because the two owners, or the not owners, they didn't own it, the people running it left. Do you know, we never paid a single bill. We were there for years, and not only did we never pay any rent, but we never paid gas. I mean, the gas was going on all day. We never got a single bill from the gas company or the electric company. So the meals and everything was really, really cheap. It was amazing. No. Well, it might be. It might be. I don't know. How was it? I don't know how all that works. But when you squat, you do exactly the same as you do in a rented house. You just get hold of the local gas company. Well, in those days, it was probably there was one gas company in England in those days and one electric company, and you just contacted them and they turned you on. You know, there you are. But for some reason, we never got any gas bills or electric bills. I don't know why. Maybe it could be that somebody subverted the gas from somewhere else. I don't know what happened. I don't know. But it was really, really cheap way to run a cafe. And what I'd like to get across somehow was the atmosphere. And it's not possible, really, to get across the atmosphere. There was a definite atmosphere. It was the alternative scene. It was post-hippie. We weren't hippies because that had happened two or three years previously, but it was very much influenced by that time. It was a few years before the punk thing came out. It was between those times. But there was definitely a feeling of idealism and adventure, and there was a kind of subversive element to the whole thing. We were definitely not interested in what we could, in those called the straight society, we were definitely not interested in that. So that gave me confidence, actually. Another thing I was doing at the centre there was I very quickly became the shrine keeper, and I took on the running of the bookshop. And it was only a tiny bookshop, because there weren't many books on Buddhism in those days. There weren't many to be had. And I remember what I did to buy new books. I went down to the Buddhist Society in Victoria. Used to get the 28 bus, used to walk across the heath, get on the 28 bus down to Victoria, go to the Buddhist Society and buy some books from them. And Christmas Humphreys, you know, have heard of Christmas Humphreys? He was one of the early British Buddhists. He was still running the place, and I did meet him once. I met Christmas Humphreys, Toby they called him. So it's a very, very different era. But running that cafe gave me confidence. And so there was something else going on. We were at the Pundurika Centre, and when I first came along, there was a lot of negotiations going on for the old fire station. And eventually the fire station was bought and people started working on it. And because I was becoming more confident in my ability to run a business, run a cafe, Subhuti asked me if I would consider setting up a Whole Food shop, because they were running out of money and they needed some businesses to get money going. So I did. I didn't actually start a shop, but what I did, he gave me £200 and I bought a van. And it was an old blue diesel van, and it unfortunately didn't have a roof. Somebody had cut the roof off. So I had to get someone to make a new roof. And it was a diesel van, and the smoke coming out of that exhaust was very, very bad, actually. It was really a very old thing. But anyway, that's what I used. And what I did was I used to go to, there were two or three places you could go to buy whole food supplies. There was this thing called Community Supplies in North London, which supplied all the hippie communities in the north of London and all the alternative shops. So you just go along there and you used to go and collect. There were all these sacks of rice and muesli everywhere. You just used to go and pick them up and put them on a trolley and just do it all yourself and then pay someone. It was all very, you just do it all yourself. So I used to do that, and I used to go to another place in South London, south of the river, called Harmony Foods, which is now, it changed its name to Real Foods. Two American brothers ran that. And another one, a new one called Sunwheel. So I used to do that, and got a market stall on Brick Lane. So every Sunday morning, me and Surita used to go and put all our food out and sell. And the stall next to us, it was always the same. It was somebody selling Shadows records, The Shadows. And he played The Shadows for the whole 3.5 hours we were there. The Shadows music for 3.5 hours every Sunday morning. That's how idealistic we were. We were prepared to do that. And so really early on, every Sunday morning, we used to go there, load the van up, take the van there, unload the van, move the van, come back, and spend 3.5 hours standing there in all weathers listening to The Shadows to make money for Sukhavati. And then I got another stall in Hampstead, which was quite nice. And they always played horrible music wherever I went to. And the other one was a squat market in Swiss Cottage next to the community cafe. And it didn't cost us anything at all to have it, and there were no rules. So usually on markets, all the food has to be bagged up. So you have to bag it, spend all week bagging the food up. But on this one, there was nobody looking at us. So we just used to go and we just had this table trestle table, and we just had everything in sacks and one of those old-fashioned scales. It was great, and people loved it. And we had queues of people because we were so cheap. We were just putting beans and rice and muesli into these things. It was just great. We had dustbins full of muesli, and we would just take this muesli out and put it. It was just so exciting. It was great. So I did that for a few years, and the Friends Food Shop that happened eventually in Bethnal Green came about because of that, and that just closed last year, so that went on for a number of years, that business. So all that was happening. Maybe a bit more personally, I'll say, just to follow in my story, which was, though I had nothing to do, came across the FWO, it was exciting. We really thought that we were changing the world, or we were going to change the world. That was definitely part of the whole atmosphere. That was part of what motivated everyone. We weren't just running a little Buddhist centre to teach people to meditate. We were actually going to change the world. And there was such confidence, actually. We were very, very confident. I suppose it's not a new thing, isn't it, when you're young and you get together and you form a movement. There must have been hundreds and thousands of movements of people thinking they were going to change the world, and we were another one. And so there I was. I got involved with this thing, and I also became a Mitra, and I became a Mitra, and I had two Kalyana Mitras, which didn't work out, actually. That was a really unfortunate thing. We didn't really know what we were doing spiritually in those days. We had, even the people who were teaching us had very, very little experience of the spiritual life. So although there was a lot of enthusiasm and commitment, there wasn't really very much wisdom, to be honest. And so I chose two Kalyana Mitras. I chose badly. They both fell in love with me, unfortunately, which made life very, very difficult for me. Very difficult indeed. But that's a story we needn't go into in too great a depth. One of them, it was Padmaraja. You saw him on there a few times. He told me, he said, have you ever thought of asking for ordination? This is just a few months into my involvement in things. And I said, no. And the reason I hadn't thought of asking for ordination is because I really didn't think I was anywhere near close to getting ordained. And I said that to him, I think. And he said, well, I was talking to Bhante Sangharakshita, and he said that if you asked for ordination, he would ordain you. Which is a big surprise. So looking back at that time, I think that probably wasn't a very good thing to tell me, I think. Maybe it was, I'm not quite sure. Because usually the initiative comes from the person rather than being told. Now, I was impressionable. So as soon as somebody tells me, you could do this, that's what I wanted to do, wasn't it? So it was not too long after that I asked for ordination. During that time, there were, I think Sona last week talked about youth, didn't he, and young people, and there were a lot of young people around, and there were four of us young guys who were involved with the Pundarika Centre. There was Suata, who you've seen, and Padmavajra from Brighton, who you saw on that film, very, very enthusiastic. And there was Ratnajyoti, and there were four of us, and Harshaprabha, five of us, fairly close, actually. And we all got ordained one after another. I got ordained with Padmavajra. First time I ever came across Padmavajra, I was on a weekend retreat, and I couldn't bear him. I really couldn't bear him. He was really, really talkative. He talked far too much, in my opinion. And he was very, very sure of himself. If you ever know Padmavajra, you'll know he's very sure of himself. And he was just like that in those days, 20 years old, and he was like, no, he's 18, I think. And he seemed to know absolutely everything there was to know about Buddhism. He knew all about it. So he could have these conversations with Bhante about tantric Buddhism, and I thought, what are they talking about? I had no idea. But he moved in the community next to where I was living, and actually we were just young and we just got to know each other. And I would say that bonds were formed in those days, which for me are still very much alive. I still love Papavadja and Suata, actually. Just really love those guys. I don't have so much to do with Harshaprabhu and Ratnajyoti, but Papavadja and Suata were very, very important to me. I was, I would say I was a lost young man, and I needed finding. And probably the FWO found me in a way. And more specifically, you saw those guys, there was Subhuti and Lokamitra, and some of the other more senior guys. I say more senior, they've been ordained a year beforehand. But it felt like, you know, when you're five and your brother's six, it seems like he's like, it was a bit like that, they were way up there. So we formed this very strong bond, which is still there. Might as well tell you a funny story. It's kind of funny and tragic story at the same time because it involves my dad. I'll tell you the tragic story first. Subhuti was talking about, and I talked about in that film, about some of the people at the old fire station, how we took anyone on, which is a big mistake, actually. And I'd moved to this squat community next to Punderica and with these other guys, Suata. And one day, I'd said that my mum left my dad became alcoholic. Over about a year or two, while I'd moved to London and got involved with the FWO, my dad had really gone downhill very, very fast. And he became so alcoholic, he lost his job. And then, of course, he lost his home because he couldn't keep it up. And he lost his car, and he lost absolutely everything, actually, including his mind. He lost his mind because he drank so much that his mind was addled. Somehow he found me. I still don't know how he found me, but he did. He just knocked on the door one day, and there was my dad. And he was in a complete and utter state. So we had to take him in. I didn't know what I was going to do with him, but his trade was he was an electrician, and I knew they needed an electrician at the old fire station. So I went to Subhuti and said, my dad's an electrician, and he said he'd take him on. So my dad went to live at the old fire station, and he stayed there for about a year and a half, 2 years in the end. It was kind of tragic because his mind was really gone. He couldn't really focus and concentrate anymore. And he was on the dole. He had to sign on when he was there. And every Thursday morning, he got his check through. And every Thursday morning, he'd disappear. No one would see him for the rest of the day. He'd get home late that night, absolutely out of his mind. And then all the money would be gone. So the next 5 days, he'd be able to work. And then come Thursday, same thing happened. That happened for 2 years, or a year and a half, something like that. Anyway, the house was still empty in Uxbridge, and I knew it was full of furniture, and we needed furniture for our squat community. So we borrowed a van. It was the FWO van, actually. We borrowed the FWO van. And we went down to Uxbridge, just Suata and I, to load the van up with furniture for our squat. So it was a Saturday night, and we'd opened up the garage and we were taking stuff into the furniture, and suddenly the police arrived and they were going to arrest us, and they thought we were just stealing stuff. So I said, no, this is my family home. Can you prove that? That's going to be a bit difficult. So I said, yeah, the next door neighbours, they'll recognise me. So we knocked up the next door neighbours and they said, no, we've never seen him before in our lives. That was a bit scary, actually, because what can you do? It was like, how can we prove to these people? But my dad had not moved up to London by then, so I had a pretty good idea where he would be, the Windsor Castle. So we took the police down to the Windsor Castle, and there he was. There was my dad. And he recognised me. And so we were okay. So that was a funny little story. But what was I going to say now? Yeah, no, you just got both there. You both got the So anyway, I'd set up Friends Foods. What else was I going to tell you about? Oh yeah, ordination. So I asked ordination because Banji had said if I asked, he'd ordain me. So I did. In a way, that was quite unfortunate because it all happened very quickly, and I got ordained with Padmavajra, so he's my Dharma brother. And I remember the night; it was a full moon, and we had our private ordination, just the two of us. And then there was silence until next morning, when there was going to be the public ordinations. And we went off for what was supposed to be a silent walk in the woods in the full moon, midsummer. And supposed to be silent, but he was so pleased with his name, Padmavajra. He couldn't. He just had to tell me his name. He was so pleased with it. And now, why am I telling you this? Oh yeah, that's right. I remember going to bed later, and then the next day. And feeling, no. I just felt fraudulent. I just felt I haven't really committed myself to the three jewels, actually. It's all been too quick and too easy. And I just thought, I wasn't convinced. I didn't really think I'd done it. Hindsight has told me I had done it, but it was quite strange because it really felt like, no. It's all going to come out in the wash, actually. I'm not really up for this kind of life. But actually, that was quite interesting because I really was very much up for it. And I started Friends Foods. I went to live at Sukhavati, which was absolutely awful, actually. Living in a squat in Pundarika on Belmore Street was great. It was a kind of hippie thing. But living in that place at Sukhavati was really awful. And so let me see. Around that time, there we were working. I ran Friends Foods from the old fire station. And I'll just finish off with this lecture series that was mentioned in the film, The Sutra of Golden Light, which Bhante called Transformation of Self and World, which was held at Hampstead Town Hall, actually, once a week for 8 weeks. So we used to troop up from Bethnal Green right up to Hampstead every, can't remember which day and night of the week it was. We used to come up in the summer and we'd listen to these lectures. And we were all dog tired, actually. We'd be sort of falling asleep through them. But there they were. And there was a kind of mythic element to it, actually. It was more than just Sangharakshita talking about Buddhism. There was, he'd somehow captured the time, the atmosphere, the zeitgeist of the time. He'd captured it and he put it through into Buddhism. He'd sort of put those two things together. Nowadays, I suppose if you listen to it, you may not catch that, but it was very much wow kind of thing. How has he done that? And one of the exciting things about it was, we felt, well, I felt that we were in some way partly responsible for those lectures because they came out of his observation of us trying to change the world by working on this old building and setting up companies and cooperatives and living together. So we were really trying to live the spiritual life in a really 24-hour way kind of thing, not just the weekend thing or one evening a week. We were trying to do it with every part of our lives. And he was observing and teaching based on his observation of what we were doing. So some of the seminars were very exciting because he would talk about things which were really happening for us. We were falling out with each other. We were running out of money. All sorts of things were happening, and he was teaching in response to that. And it felt to me like those lectures were partly his response to what we were doing. It was very, very exciting. And I was just looking at the list of lectures on them, actually. I mean, the title, Transformation of Self and World. This is new. I mean, this was new in Buddhism. Nowadays, Buddhism, there are about 30 Buddhist groups in Manchester, I think. In London, there were three or four. It was there was hardly anything going on. There was the Buddhist Society, there was a Burmese place, and there was the Friends of Western Buddhist Order. Probably that was it. So it really felt like we were doing something important and exciting. And so the list of lectures, one of them I noticed was Buddhist economics based on Schumacher's work. And another one was Buddhism and culture. And throughout the whole lecture series, he was weaving in themes which were really, really important to us. It felt really good, actually, very, very good. So we did those lectures, we went to those lectures, and they affected us, you know, in turn. So we were very inspired and we changed the way we did things. In the end, I just had to get the hell out of there. I just moved to Manchester. First opportunity I had, I just got out of there and moved to Manchester. And that was a whole nother story. What I've discovered, it doesn't work very well if you escape from somewhere very quickly into something else. You usually end up in a position which is as bad, if not worse, than the one you just escaped from. So I've learnt that over the years. So I think that'll do. Because we said we'd have questions, didn't we? So should we stop and see if you've got any questions?
When did you move up here?
I think it was 1979. I think it was 79. Yeah. Two order members and a Mitra had moved up here from London 6 months previously, Sagarmati, Lalita Vajra, and Ratnajyoti, yeah, they'd moved up, and they wanted me to move up, partly because I'd set up Friends Foods, and they thought I could set up Friends Foods here as well, which I tried to do, but didn't succeed. Yeah, I'd say I did bring with me a sense of idealism, but it was very, very hard because we literally had nothing. We rented a very old, not very nice house in Longsight. We lived there. I think Ratnajyoti had a job, and maybe Lalita Vajra did too, but Sagarmati didn't, and I didn't. So I was going to set up this. And basically, we didn't have any money. But we were very idealistic. We got these posters printed, and we used to go out and put them on walls, you know, with glue, wallpaper glue, which was illegal. And you know this story. I was arrested once. I was out on my own, wallpaper glue, posters, putting them up. And a plainclothes policeman came up, excuse me, sir, and he took me off to a police station and arrested me. The reason he arrested me, because there was a gang. You know all these massive big posters you see around the place? Pop posters, rock posters. That's all illegal. But there's a gang. There's always a gang, at least one gang, of guys who goes around putting them up. And they get paid from the venues to do that. But it's illegal. So the police every now and then just clamp down. And anyway, somebody complained about this gang who I didn't know. They were just around the corner. And I somehow got involved with this wrongly. So I was putting this back of this truck, and there's this gang there, and I was just taken along with them. So yeah, so there was a lot of idealism, and basically in those days I would have done anything to get people into Buddhism. I would have done anything. And I did. I did do loads and loads of things, which I probably wouldn't do now, but I would have done anything, because it just, like, that was the whole point of living, was to get people into the Dharma, you know. So I just did that. I didn't mind going around and putting posters up on walls and some of the other things we got up to. Yeah. So there was a lot of idealism, but it was really, really tough, the first 10 years in Manchester, actually, because there's nothing going on. We were like ready, and nobody came to classes. We were just stuck in this little house, falling out with each other. It was horrible, really horrible. I see, Sivaji was up here a couple of weeks ago, and there was about 25 order members here, and he came up to me and he said, "Just look at this. look at all these order members here. Do you remember 20 years ago we used to sit in the Chicago Diner in Withington, and I would be like despairing. It's like, what's the point? You know, what are we doing this for? But it's, I mean, look what we've got now. It's just great. So yeah, loads and loads of idealism. Stacks of it. Never seemed to run out. Well, it did occasionally when I got really despairing. But yeah. 9 Elcliffe Grove. It's just off Dickinson Road, near the park, quite near the park. The house is still there, although it's got a new front now. So it's been done up new. Mr. Salt was our landlord.
Can I take you back to those days in London?
London, yeah. Back. Yeah.
So something that came out in the film was sort of the single-sex tension thing. Mm. So, you know, Bento was encouraging single-sex communities. And, I mean, as I remember that counterculture, that idea must have been so
anathema.
Uncool.
Yeah, it was really uncool, yeah.
Can you say anything about that?
Well, it was so uncool, it was cool, if you know what I mean. It was so sort of like, it was radical even for hippies. It felt... Our take on it was we were going further. Yeah, we weren't stepping back in time. We were actually going further. That was our take on it. And a lot of women did get very upset, as you saw in that film, more upset than they showed. Apart from Marlene, showed quite a lot of upset. And there was a lot of upset, actually. I didn't particularly get involved in it. I was young, good-looking. The women liked me. And I was very not outspoken.
And the men did as well.
The men really liked me, yeah. But because I was very impressionable, I wasn't really one of the bad guys from the women's point of view, if you know what I mean. So I didn't really get involved in, but I know that some of the women were very, very upset by it.
Hmm. Can I just ask about that? Because I was around, it was my era as well.
Yeah.
Just around the diversity of people linked into the Buddhist movement then, you know, because I was involved, and I was involved in women's movements.
Yeah. Yeah, the people coming to our centre weren't part of that culture, really. It was really quite, in a way, although I've talked about it as being subversive and counterculture, it wasn't politically so, if you know what I mean. It was more idealistic, from very much influenced by the hippie thing, really. So we didn't really have that kind of culture. Probably we'd have heard of it, but nobody really had much experience of that. So there wasn't any woman in the order or involved who said, look, let's do this. There wasn't really anyone doing that. So it really did feel unfortunate, actually. And what really wasn't brought out in the film, but I think we have to say, was the fact that everyone had fundraised for that building. Everyone, women involved, me included. And the whole thing was, we were all going to go there. And then suddenly somebody made a decision that, no, the women aren't going to go there. So that was really unfortunate, the way that happened, I would say. Not very good. But as I say, I was just a young beginner, so I wasn't really involved in that kind of decision-making process. But there was a lot of unhappiness and resentment, I would say, and bitterness. Yeah. There was also another thing, which was... there was quite a lot of, you have to remember we were young, and there was a lot of, I suppose it would be called arrogance. There's quite a lot of arrogance involved in it all. And I think what happened, I think that should have been dealt with very, very sensitively. And probably it wasn't, you know. Probably it wasn't dealt with sensitively. It was probably dealt with a little bit triumphally, you know, it's just like, no, this is what's going to happen because this is the way it's going to be. And probably it was a bit like that. Although I can't say for sure because I wasn't really involved in all the discussions that were happening.
I think it was a mistake to ordained people so early on.
Well, I thought it was a mistake to ordain me, but now I would say it wasn't. I think Banti must have seen something in me which I was not confident enough to see myself. Some people who got ordained young in those days left later. But then some people around for 10 years and they get ordained and then they leave later. It's hard to say. It's very easy in retrospect to say we shouldn't have ordained that person, but at the time it's quite difficult to know. I wasn't the youngest person by any means to be ordained. I was ordained with Papa Vajra, and I think he was 18. He was the youngest person ever to get ordained at that point. A few years later, I was on an ordination retreat in Italy, and Yeshudeva got ordained at 17. Funny enough, at the time, he'd just been refused to be a mitra at the Brighton Centre that he came from because he hadn't been around long enough. And a week later, he got ordained. It was very, and he's still an order member, you know. He's middle-aged now, and he's still very much into things. So it's hard to say. You know, sometimes young people get them ordained, and that's fine.
And were all those ordinations still directly by Bante?
Everything was by Bante, yeah. Everything. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't said anything about Bante, but he was a very strange character to have around. Not that he was around very much when I was around, but he was in the background all the time. Lived in this little cottage in Norfolk. I went up to see him. Lokamitra took me up to see him over a weekend, and yeah, he's a strange man, Banti, I would say. In those days, he kind of had an aura of his strangeness was okay, because he had this long hair and he was very hippie-fied in a way. But some of the things he said were kind of outrageous. And that was so exciting to have a kind of, well, I considered an old man, but he was only 40 something. But he seemed like, you know, I was 20, he seemed like a man from my dad's generation. But he was saying the really quite outrageous things about society and life and men and women. And it was just really exciting, you know, to have him around. And when he gave talks, it just felt like, I don't know, we were listening to really important stuff, you know, and we really needed to take this on board. And it was really good, actually. Very good. He was a strange, enigmatic, strange in the sense of enigmatic figure. But so eloquent and articulate. It was, yeah. I'd never met anyone like that before in my life. Still haven't, I suppose. Oh, definitely wouldn't have progressed. I say it was a cooperative thing. I think he had a lot to do with it, actually. Because of the radical nature of his vision of what we could achieve. If he hadn't had that, we would never have tried to achieve it. But he knew that if we just, hey, why don't we just live together? You know, wow, phew, Buddhists living together. That's a completely new idea. Why don't we set up businesses, you know, so that we can work together as well? That all came from him. So although he wasn't actually rolling his sleeves up and doing it, that all came from us. The inspiration and the ideas very much, not all the ideas, some of the ideas came from us as well, but it was very much a two-way process. So, and he would teach in that kind of way. You know, he really knew his Buddhism, but he was able to adapt it to our particular situations. And so it was all really, really exciting. So I'd say it was very much cooperative. Yeah. Yeah. It was good, yeah.